Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson.
Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. I hope all is going well with all of you. I really do. You know, one of the reasons so-called progressives hate President Trump and his supporters with the heat of a thousand suns is his slogan that became a movement, Make America Great Again. Because the left violently rejects the notion that America ever was great. They violently reject the concept of American exceptionalism. Remember when Barack Obama said he thinks America is exceptional in the same way that the British believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism? They violently reject the idea that America ever can be great unless it is, as Barack Obama put it, fundamentally transformed by being deconstructed, dismantled, destroyed, and rebuilt from the ashes into a progressive utopia. Of course, as I always say, utopian dreams always, always, always turn into dystopian nightmares. But the left, while pushing full steam ahead toward a dystopian future, loves to accuse conservatives of wanting to roll back the clock and take America back to a time when blacks and women knew their place in this country, a mythic time when misogynistic white supremacy ruled. They think that's what we mean when we say we want to make America great again. Well, that's all just bigoted, stupid nonsense on the part of progressives who don't understand what conservatives want because they don't know any conservatives. They live, as I once did, in a tightly circumscribed little bubble of smug, self-righteous self-satisfaction with other ignorant progressives who are disconnected from reality and don't understand the political opponents that they hatefully smear as fascists and Nazis. That's not the America we conservatives want to reclaim. We don't believe America was ever perfect. The best of what we have lost. We want to restore American preeminence in the world. We want to restore middle-class prosperity. Most of all, we want to restore a sense that America is oriented again toward the true, the good, and the beautiful. One of the things progressives seem to lack that conservatives have is a patriotic appreciation for the beauty and grandeur of this magnificent country, and a sense of being rooted in its extraordinary and diverse landscape. Today at The Right Take, I have a guest who has compiled a collection of essays into a new book devoted to the idea of reclaiming the sense of American beauty and a spiritual connection to the landscape that used to inspire Americans to feel a surge of love and gratitude for this exceptional country. I think it's important to talk about this ideal and how to restore it to the center of our political discourse as we fight to make America great again. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture has spent his life working in nonprofits that are committed to preserving America's freedoms. He's worked for the Heartland Institute, the Claremont Institute, both great institutions, and for I don't know how many years, for the David Horowitz Freedom Center, where he is the president. But that title, president, doesn't really encompass everything that he is and has been for all these years at the Freedom Center. David Horowitz was, of course, the intellectual force behind the center, the head. But my guest has been everything else, the respiratory system, the nervous system, the circulatory system, everything that kept and continues to keep the body of the center functioning. And in addition to that, he somehow manages to write many, many essays, a couple of books of poetry, and a brand new book collected from those essays called A Time to Stand, The Dire Hour to Defend American Beauty. He's also a good friend, I'm honored to say. Michael Finch, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. And I'll practice some humility. Nothing would happen at the Freedom Center without having a great team, which, of course, you're a critical part of. And we have great writers, and it's all a team effort. And it's been over 20 years, and we're doing some great work. And I couldn't be prouder to be part of the center. And we, of course, miss David tremendously. But we've got a great staff and a great group of writers, and proud to call you a friend and to be really one of the critical pieces of Freedom Center. So thank you for everything you do.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be part of it. And it's great to have you here, Mike. You know, I actually don't know, but what is your background? Because a lot of your writing has to do with a sort of nostalgia about Middle America, a peaceful heartland that seems like a thing of the past, or maybe just gets neglected in our focus on coastal politics. But did you grow up in that kind of heartland?
Yeah, I was born in Peoria, Illinois, but I was born there, but grew up in the Chicago area and stayed there all the way through college and a little bit after. I went into, before college, I was in the Air Force for 4 years, so traveled around the world for those 4 years, came back and went to DePaul University in Chicago. And then around almost, gosh, it's been almost 30 years now, I moved to California. So the second half of my life, I've been in California. And of course, now I'm shuttling between Japan and California. So continue to travel. But, you know, my roots are all in the Midwest. I love the Midwest. I spent some time living in Wisconsin. I've done a lot of traveling, of course. But, you know, Illinois will always be home, and the Midwest and the heartland is where my heart is. But although I love America, there's so much beauty to the country. And I've actually been to 45 states. I haven't been to all 50. Wow. Yeah, the heartland is really special. I mean, I'm a Midwesterner through and through.
Now, many conservatives like David Horowitz and myself had political conversions. David's was much more dramatic and interesting than mine. But were you always a conservative-minded patriot?
Yeah, it's funny because who has the quote that if when you're young, you're if you have, you know, you have a heart, you're a liberal, and then you of course kind of wise up when you're older and become a conservative. So I guess that means I'm heartless because I've been a conservative since birth. I've never had that kind of left leaning moment. So I'm the traditional conservative. I was upset when Ronald Reagan lost in the primary to Gerald Ford, and I was only maybe about 14 years old at that point. So that tells you how far back that goes. But I love Barry Goldwater and all of them. So yeah, I've always been a conservative, but you know, I learned a lot. I know a little bit about your background. Of course, David is the classic case. I think when you're on the left or left leaning, you when you become a conservative, you have so much. I learned so much from people like you and David who had some kind of leanings that other way. David is again the extreme example, but we can learn a lot from people that have kind of made that change. There's no question. And I never had that, and I'm happy to have never had that, but you know, it's a learning lesson, and you can learn a lot from going through that transition, I'm sure.
And how did you come to cross paths with David and begin working for the center?
Well, when I came to California, I was working with the Claremont Institute. And of course, Larry Arnn, who's now the president of Hillsdale, he was one of the founders of the Claremont Institute, and he was still the president of the Claremont Institute. So I worked for Larry for a few years. And then Larry left when he had the opportunity to go run Hillsdale, and they had some changes. And I figured it was kind of time. I felt like it was time for a change. And I got introduced. David was looking for an executive director. So I kind of jumped at the opportunity. He was living in Malibu at the time, and I had an interview at his house, and he called me on the drive home and said, I want to hire you, and that was it. So that was, like I said, almost 23 years ago, and the rest is history. And it was a great, you know, a great 20-plus years that I've had and continue to have. The center does such important work, and of course, David, just a phenomenal person, and to work with him at his side for all those years, I learned a lot, and you know, the center is thriving and doing well. So, but yeah, it was just kind of by chance that I was introduced to David, and the timing was right for both of us.
Perfect. And I mentioned at the outset that you've written a couple of books of poetry. Have you always been drawn to reading and writing poetry? Because that seems like kind of a lost art, a lost appreciation also.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I had written poetry even, you know, but when I was in my teens a little bit, and then I continued in my 20s. Then I took kind of sporadically was writing some poems through my 30s and 40s. And then, you know, when I got into my, of course, I'm 63 now, but in my 50s, I really started writing a lot of poetry. And if I had more time, I would write more. And I was never trained as a poet, and professional poet critics have kind of eviscerated me in some ways because I don't follow the perfect kind of whatever. I don't know what a perfect poem is supposed to be, but apparently I don't, I thought poetry is more open, kind of expressive, but it's just one way of, for me to communicate feelings and thoughts. And particularly when it comes to America, I've written a lot of poems about America and thank you, by the way, for your introductions in the new book. So I really appreciate that, Mark. And I know you have an appreciation for poetry. It's kind of a niche. Not a lot of Americans read yes. poetry. And frankly, Mark, when I read modern poetry, half the time I have no idea what it means or what it. So I love the classic poets, and there are some great poets now. But I'd want to say it's a dying art. But there are a lot of people that write poetry. But it's something, it's not for everybody. Let's put it that way. But I love to write poetry and I love to read poetry.
Who are a few of your favorites or inspirations maybe? I know you're drawn to Christian poets like Gerard Manley Hopkins. I know T.S. Eliot's one of your favorites. He's one of mine too. In fact, my son Elliot is named after him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, Gerard Manley Hopkins is my favorite poet. I love, Keats and William Butler Yeats. I mean, there's so many great poets. In modern, I think, Wendell Berry he's still alive. He just published a novel. I love Wendell Berry. There are some great American poets, Walt Whitman, Robert Frost. So there are some tremendous American poets. And that's kind of what I touch on in the book, that America, as far as literature and poetry, I think, we probably can't match the English poet. They're great poets, but we do have some outstanding poets. But Ivor Gurney, who wrote during, he was a British poet during the First World War, one of the forgotten war poets, mm-hmm. tremendous poet. So there's so many great ones. Robert Penn Warren is another one. He actually was a poet laureate of the United States. He wrote, of course, All the King's Men, that great novel.
Yeah.
But he was a fantastic poet, another one of my favorite 20th century poets. So the classics and some of the modern, and there are some modern poets that I enjoy reading as well. T.S. Eliot is classic. And let's face it, he wrote, the most famous poem in the 20th century, the one that probably had the most impact in the wasteland. So, and yeah. I mentioned that in the book at least once or twice. So, your son was named after a great man, a great writer, a great poet. So you couldn't have done that better, Mark.
I think it's easy for a lot of conservatives today. Well, people in general, but I think especially conservatives, to dismiss fiction and poetry as somehow sort of frivolous, maybe. But on the contrary, what do poets and poetry have to teach us, or what can they show us?
Well, poetry, really good poetry. I mean, it's emotive and expressive in a way that you can't a novel. I mean, I love reading novels, and novels have their own way. Joseph Epstein wrote an great book a couple of years ago, The Novel Who Needs It. And of course, he came to the conclusion that novels are really critical because they have a way of interpreting life and things that happen in life in a way that literature can do that, where in other modes of art can't. Poetry is so expressive. It brings out something, I think, in your emotions. For me, it's, I do lean on nostalgia a lot. So a lot of my poetry is expressive in a nostalgic way. But poetry, whether it's about America or whether it's about love or whatever, heartache, or, you're trying to express feelings in poetry in a way, at least for me, reading poetry brings out feelings that there's no other form of art can do that. And, some of Walt Whitman's greatest poems were about America, The Open Road in America. And he can express that in a poem that you don't get. A painting has its own way of expressing. A novel has its own way. Speaking has its own way. But poetry is special from a very emotive standpoint. And that's where it really hits me. And that's why I love poetry so much.
Yeah, and I think one of the aspects of poetry that's important is the heightened language of it really sort of touches on the transcendent, and it draws people, the best poetry, I think, really draws people toward the true, the good, and the beautiful. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, Gerard Manley Hopkins, I mean, God's Grandeur. I mean, there's a couple of his poems. Really, when I talk about this in the book, you know, great art is the beauty in art is in an expression and the effort to kind of reach the heavens. I mean, you're praising God and you're doing this for God. We can't reach that level. The left would like to think we can be our own gods on this earth. We can't. We fail miserably. But trying to express, I mean, Bach had written one time that every piece of music he wrote was for the good of God. It was to worship God. And poetry, when you can be that expressive, and there are several poets who have been able to do that, you know, you reach towards the heavens. You may fall short, but there's an expression there and an opening to God that I think is very rare, but it's in art. It's the one way, you know, that's where art and beauty are so important. You know, and I was going back to think, you know, when in The Wasteland, T.S. Eliot, you know, World War I was such a destructive war. I think the most destructive war in Christendom and modern history. You could write, a lot of books were written about it, a lot of movies, a lot of poetry. But The Wasteland expresses the destruction of World War I, the end of that world that we knew better than anything. That's probably the best example, at least in the modern era, of a poem that expresses something that cannot be expressed in that way in any other. It has never been expressed in quite the way that T.S. Eliot did. Gerard Manley Hopkins, that's why I like religious poetry. Some of his poems really put you in a place where you can almost, it's heavenly, and you can almost touch God. We can't touch God, at least not in this life, but you can almost touch God in great poetry. So, yeah, I think great art, the best art, the best architecture, the best paintings, there's an expression there that is religious in the sense it doesn't have to be obviously or openly religious, but there is that kind of quest and that feature in the artist that is, again, trying to reach the heavens. And that is the most beautiful art the world has ever produced.
Yeah, and I think that transcendent aim is something that's really lacking in modern culture and is part of our decadence in the modern world. And I think it's something that we have to kind of reclaim or restore. I used the word nostalgia a few minutes ago. You mentioned it. But I don't want to give the impression that by nostalgia, I mean that you are using a cheap sentimentalism. You know, the writer Anthony Esselin, who's actually been on this podcast, has a book about nostalgia in which he describes nostalgia as a kind of spiritual homesickness, the soul's desire to find its true home. Would you agree that that's what it is? And would you agree that kind of characterizes your work?
I do. I'll have to read that book, Mark. I mean, I agree with that 100%. And I mentioned in the introduction of the book that Christopher Lash, talks about nostalgia quite a bit. And it's not like he's anti-nostalgic, but and I tend to agree with this. If you rely too much on nostalgia, then you get this kind of disjointed and inaccurate view of it. If you idolize the past to a point where it becomes dreamlike and otherworldly, and I think you got to be careful with nostalgia, you know, and he stresses memory. But I think nostalgia has a place. I mean, there, you know,
yes,
I mentioned we could talk about the greatness of the things that were great in America that have changed, right? That they're not that way now. I don't think it's pure nostalgia to say we need to be able to go back and restore certain things that we don't have today. So I think it's a mixture of both. But that's the way that he paraphrased it, I think, is fascinating. And you know, so much of my book and why I wrote the book and all these essays is, you know, you read a book, and I was mentioning Joseph Epstein's The Novel Who Needs It. Well, he talks about Willa Cather in that novel, in the book. And I knew of Willa Cather, but I'd never read Willa Cather. And once I found out about Willa Cather, because he mentioned it, mentioned her as one of the great American, if not the greatest American novelist, I read all her novels within about a six-month period. And my point is, you get pointed in the direction of something, and you just mentioned an author who I've not read. Now I'm going to order the book and I'm going to read the book, and then that takes you down another path. And you know this. We don't have enough years in our life to read everything and absorb everything. But there's nothing more wonderful than finding an author, finding an artist or a poet. An architect to go look at the buildings or landscape, to go travel. And that leads you on a journey and down a path that you cannot even imagine. And it's wonderful. Yes. And I kind of urge Americans to recover that, reach out, read things and see things and travel and do things to explore the country and this great culture to kind of restore it. And then you can teach your children about the wonders of this great country.
So much of this book, A Time to Stand, and your poetry for that matter, are rooted in the sights and the sounds, the beauty of the sweeping American landscape, the whole amber waves of grain and purple mountain majesties and all that. Do you think that Americans, especially in our decaying urban centers, have lost a connection to those roots and to that landscape? And does that partially explain our decline?
I think absolutely. I mean, in a lot of this, you know, if not everyone can get out and, you know, do road trips across the country. I understand that. It's great if you can get out and see the beautiful parts. Even California is as decayed and decrepit and wounded as California is. It has some of the most stunning landscape in the entire world, as you know. Yeah. So, you know, getting out and seeing the country. But I agree. I mean, I went to school. I think we're about the same age, Mark. So we were schooled in the 1960s and 70s primarily, and then maybe college later. But even then, I mean, I was not told, I was not instructed or assigned to read any of the, most of them. We read John Steinbeck maybe, but, you know, we really weren't instructed to read some of these other great writers. And also the great landscape artists, America, the landscape is so critical. Thomas Cole and Albert Bierstadt and all the great landscape painters of the 19th century, I stumbled upon them just by happenstance. You read about them, or you pick up a book of art and you see the painting, pictures of the paintings. And we need to get in touch with that, because the landscape is critical. I think it's probably critical, you know, for most countries, but America's different. And yes. I'm not saying this as a slight to the Native Americans. I mean, you know, it was inevitable that the civilizations would clash like they did. It's tragic. It's one of those stains, and I'm not going to ignore the stains in American history. We have such greatness as well. But America was kind of seen, it was an empty canvas ready to be written about and ready to be painted. And it's extraordinary. I think American art and American culture is so aspirational, the sea to shining sea, manifest destiny. And we painted and wrote our way across the country and created this magnificent culture. And I think, again, if you'd asked me in my 30s about Albert Bierstadt, I would have no idea. Would have no idea who that was, because I wasn't educated on that Hudson River School, that group of artists. And now it is incredibly beautiful. And I could say the same about some of the buildings, some of the state capitals and some of the other buildings and around the country. And I'm bouncing around probably too much, Mark, but talk about religion and trying to reach God. Well, our architect, Thomas Jefferson, the great first architect of the country, wanted Washington, D.C. to be designed in the classical manner based on Greek and Roman. Well, the Greeks and Romans, at least not initially, not the great Roman Empire and the Greek Empire and Athens, though they were pre-Christian. So it's not a question that, you know, they designed and architect and builted some of the most beautiful edifices and buildings and structures the world has ever seen. So, but they were reaching something else. Maybe they're reaching their own gods, right? Or, you know, whatever it was that they were trying to achieve, it's kind of the same thing. So it's not necessarily, doesn't have to be only Christian art can be stunning, because the Parthenon and buildings in ancient Rome were incredibly stunning. I mean, these are some of the greatest buildings ever built in human history. But they were trying to reach for something. So that again, going back to that, but you need to be introduced to, we need to teach about this great art and especially the great culture in America. It's really critical.
Well, you've already partially touched on this now, but I wanted to bring up that the subtitle of your book is The Dire Hour to Defend American Beauty. Why American beauty? Why is it important and meaningful to restore a sense of beauty at the heart of our appreciation of America?
I think, you know, the culture binds us in a way that, the schools, and we've talked a lot, maybe not on the show, but we've talked a lot over, you know, the years that we've known each other and been involved with the Freedom Center. The campuses and the schools in this country are just government-run schools are a disaster. It doesn't mean there aren't any good ones, and it doesn't mean there aren't any good teachers, but, you know, private schools, vouchers, homeschooling, there's all these things, but the education establishment is corrupt. The teachers' unions have destroyed public education almost completely in this school. So we've got, in this country, so we have so much to make up for. The conservatives, you know, through the think tanks and the few like Hillsdale College and some of the other outposts, they do a great job in teaching about the American founding, about the Federalist Papers, the Declaration, the Constitution, the Gettysburg Address, all of that. We do a really good job of trying to reach people with that, but we don't do enough on American culture. And that's, I mean, even in high school, they're still teaching, you know, about, you know, the Gettysburg Address and the Declaration of Independence. They may not be teaching it entirely the proper way, but it's not like a child, if he's half awake and paying attention, he knows about something about the Constitution. American beauty is the architecture, the art, the literature, the poetry, all those things that enrich American culture. It is from about the mid-1800s to about 1920. That was the golden age of American culture. The best writing, the best poetry, the beautiful, all the state capitals, most of the state capitals that were built in that style, and the federal buildings, all of that during that period united, and the artist wanted to have a consistent theme that's aspirational. They didn't just, you know, scribble something on a canvas just for the heck of it. They actually, there was a purpose to say, this is America, it's beautiful, and we want people to see America as this incredibly aspirational, beautiful, rising nation. So we have to teach that. That, to me, teaching those things is just as important as the Federalist Papers, because that all that's great. We need to have the civics and the political history, but we must have the culture. I think American beauty, Mark, because our culture is that beautiful. It is one of the most stunning cultural histories, I think, in world history. And that's what unites and binds us, I think, as much as anything else, as much as the Declaration or the Gettysburg Address. Our beautiful culture can bind us and unite us in a way that I think politics can't, as important as politics is.
Yes, well said. You note early on in the book that American culture is rotting, which I would totally agree with. Conservatives seem to have more trouble understanding the importance of culture than the left does, although I think that's changing for conservatives. But that's why the left has been able to infiltrate and dominate all of our cultural arenas. With Trump in office, our side finally seems to be regaining some cultural momentum. Do you think that we can ever reclaim or restore the best aspects of American culture before that cultural rot began to take hold?
I do, Mark. I mean, bringing back, you know, an author from the 1910, you know, that's going to be a heavy haul in school, you know, but we need to at least introduce students to some of these ideas, some of the beautiful art. But I'm going to give an example of something American, and I still believe in the faith and the common sense of the American people. Look, we elected Trump twice, arguably three times, but that's an argument for another day. But, you know, the majority of the Americans put someone in the White House who wants to restore America's greatness. So, and we understand beauty, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Well, not really, right? I mean, in some aspects, but, you know, a Rembrandt is more beautiful than mud on a wall, right? A landscape painting from the 19th century is more appealing than putting a cross and urine in a painting, right? I mean, that's the crudeness of American culture and modern architecture. And I'm going to bring up an example. The Pasadena City Hall, Arthur Brown was his firm, and he was the architect, one of the great architects. He designed a lot of the beautiful federal buildings in Washington. He designed the City Hall in San Francisco, which is one of the most beautiful buildings in the country, if not the world. He also designed City Hall in Pasadena. So for everyone in SoCal, Southern California, take a drive to Pasadena and look at the City Hall. And if you go there on especially on a Friday or Saturday night, you see throngs of people there with their photo. They're getting wedding shots and prom dates, and everyone wants to go to Pasadena City Hall in their courtyard and have their picture taken. Okay, now it is one of the most beautiful pieces of classic. It's got some Spanish influence, but for the most part, it's classical with some Spanish that updated it a little bit from the pure classical. you can go to Van Nuys, the city hall in Van Nuys, which is a concrete slab. Nobody goes there for a photo opportunity, right? So Americans know what's beautiful and what's not. They just, you know, we just need to kind of introduce and talk about these things so we can educate and say, these are the beautiful aspects of American culture. People are drawn to it, I think, naturally. People know what a beautiful poem is. They know what a beautiful book is. They know what a beautiful, you know, painting, and they know what a beautiful building looks like, and they know what ugly looks like. And the left hates beauty. I really yes. do believe that. So I think just based on kind of the common sense and the goodness of the American people, I think they're yearning to get in touch with what's beautiful. And that can be in all aspects of, you know, it doesn't have to just be American beauty and American culture, but American culture in particular, because it unites us. I think people are thirsty for that kind of, to be in touch with something that's beautiful and aspirational. The immigrants that come to this country legally, right, hopefully, want to love this country. They want to become Americans. And I think yes. they need, you know, learn English, of course, and be taught about the beauty of American culture. This is your new country. This is your new land. And a lot of the beautiful golden age of American history was for the immigrant. So the immigrant would see something aspirational in America. Yes, the Declaration of Independence and all of that, but also the beautiful landscape, the beautiful writing, the beautiful buildings. That was meant to kind of bring them into the American mainstream and yeah. become Americans. So I'm convinced that we can turn this around.
The book's divided into five sections, one of which ranges beyond America and addresses international crises, in which you write about false utopias and their victims. What is it about the left's worldview? And I've written and spoken about this a lot, and I know you have. What is it about the left's worldview that always, when they hold the reins of power, leads to mass misery and death?
Well, I've got to thank our mentor for all these years, David Horowitz, right, for being yes. at his kind of side and reading so much of what, you know, the left, you know, you and I know that we're as Christians, and you don't have to be Christian to believe that we can't create utopia on earth. But as Christians in particular, we know that heaven is not going to happen in this lifetime. It's not going to happen on earth. So we wait the next. We wait to see what's going to happen next to find that kind of perfect utopia. It's not going to happen in this lifetime. We're all flawed. We've all sinned, right? So we understand human nature, and human nature never changes. All right. So having yes. that, and the founders understood that. The left, however, rejects that. They want to destroy the idea of the Judeo-Christian kind of moral beliefs, and they want to create utopia, and they believe they can create that heaven on earth here.
Yeah.
The problem is we stand in the way of it. At least that's in their view. So Lenin and Stalin and Mao, we talked about how the left hates the beauty of America. They hate American history. It wasn't 1776. It was 1619 when the first slave was brought over. In order to create this heaven on earth and this utopia, you need to destroy what was there before. So the greatness of Russian culture and everything before the revolution had to be destroyed. Mao tried to destroy the whole, you know, 2,000 years of Confucian philosophy and the beauty and the temples and everything in China. He tried to destroy all that because he's trying to create the new Chinese man, or as the Russians were trying to create the new Soviet man. That means destroying everything that was happened before. And by doing that, you don't just destroy a building or a temple or whatever, or you know, an Orthodox church in Russia. You have to destroy the people too, because we're the ones that are standing athwart all that. So, and that's why inevitably, when you have these revolutions and the left takes power, it's not just a few people going to jail. Millions of people have died in the last 100 and whatever, you know, started in the French Revolution, really. But this idea of creating this utopia, although the idea of becoming man and creating a heaven on earth has existed, and wanting to be God has existed since the garden, right? So this is never going to leave us. And Mark, we're never going to be able to claim victory, not in this life. If you're a Christian, you believe that at some point there will be the ultimate victory. But in this life, we're never going to be able to say we've defeated the left, because that that impulse that left this kind of utopia is never going to leave. They're always driven by it. And that's why Ronald Reagan said, we're going to have to fight every generation, and we're going to have to fight every generation. So leftism inevitably leads to the death of the destruction of civilizations and the death of millions. And to think that it can happen here would be fool. It can happen anywhere. And it has happened in so many parts of the world.
Yeah, you just can't socially engineer a heaven on earth without almost immediately having to resort to coercion.
So exactly. Yeah.
You have to force people to believe, to act the way that you want them to act in order to create this, perfect society. And that's why, the left always, that utopian vision turns totalitarian almost immediately.
Oh, absolutely. And we're the reactionaries the kulaks, right? I mean, we're the ones that are going to end up in the camps, or they're going to be the ones that end up killed, because that's what they have to do. And if you're going to create this perfect heaven, then what is one person's, the sacrifice of people, even by the millions, is worth it if you're creating heaven on earth, in their view. So they don't look back, and there's never been an apology about what the left has done, right? I mean, of course, China's still communist, but, Russia's had some, kind of look back at the gulags, but there's also a lot of, they've never like officially said, this was a horrible thing that the communists did in the Soviet Union. They haven't had that kind of moment, and maybe they never will. So being a kind of a leftist means never saying you're sorry for what, there's never an apology, because it was just done the wrong way. We need to do it right the next time. And, I've got a book on my shelf here, To Overthrow the World, The Rise and Fall and Then the Rise Again of Communism. And it's really going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. That impulse, those leftist illusions are always going to be driving people. So this is something, we can push back, and we can save this generation. Maybe we can save the next few generations, but we're going to have to be vigilant and keep fighting and fighting.
Well, the book it's a really wide-ranging collection of essays. But is there one overarching thing or message that you hope readers will take away from the book?
Yeah, I think to go back on the concept of beauty and art and literature and poetry, and I do, there's a couple of times I write about America, but you're right, there's articles about everything. So I do write about this kind of leftist impulse and the battle that we're in, this great battle that we're in to try to save Western civilization and Judeo-Christian, that kind of ethic and those ideas that have created this great civilization. So that's one of the major themes. But I really lean on beauty and art and the effort of grounding ourselves to know that we are fallen, that we're not perfect, we're not going to create the heaven on earth, to have humility and to always be trying to achieve kind of that to reach to the heavens. To express ourselves in all aspects of life and our history and in our country. And again, America, incredibly aspirational, so exceptional in so many different ways, in spite of the faults. I hope we can get to the point where we're not just teaching the Howard Zinn version of American history in our schools, but teaching the greatness as well, and understand that America has this incredibly beautiful culture, which I think is kind of been forgotten, or it's just not being taught. And we need to restore that. And then we need to teach our children about the wonders and beauty of this culture, because it binds us, again, it binds us together as Americans, just as much as the kind of political documents that founded us.
Another section in the book is called The Beloved Land in Crisis. What's a major way, or maybe a couple of ways, if you like, in which you think America is facing a serious crisis or crises today?
Well, I mean, there's so many. I mean, economically, we destroyed our manufacturing base. Donald Trump understands that. I think it's one of the reasons why, he won this second term, is because the American middle class, the working class, has been devastated. And I think we've just sold out primarily to China, but there's other countries as well. We've completely... I think in a lot of it was in greed, trying to make a lot of money. We just offshored everything. And that has led to, you know, declining, you know, life expectancy declines, depression, alcoholism, drugs. There are so many things that ail us. I think that, and I think it's not all economic. So much of it is, of course, spiritual as well. And, you know, we're also, and I really don't get into this in detail to the book, and I know this is something that you think about. We're going through something, I think, even more more upheaval than the Industrial Revolution. The information revolution is leading us in ways that we just cannot predict, right? So we're going into a path where deindustrializing. I don't think, you know, we need to bring manufacturing back, but technology is advancing so fast, and that includes, yeah. You know, and you've studied AI a lot more than I have, Mark, but we're going down something that I think that in a direction that, you know, we can't really get a grasp of, but and America is so, and I don't mean this as a criticism, although I guess it is, we are so individualistic that we've kind of, you know, and some of that I think, and I don't want to get into a kind of a too deep of a spiritual conversation because I'm probably not as versed in it as well as I have, but, you know, the Reformation put the emphasis on the individual as opposed to the Catholic, and I'm a Protestant, you know, I'm not a Catholic, but the Reformation put the individual on your sole individual relationship with our Savior, right, and God. So that has driven us in a way to become an incredibly, I think, hyper-individualistic society, and part of that was the kind of radical Protestantism that came to America. So, and you know, we are a country, I think, with a people that have lost connections, and I don't want to say we're too individualistic, because I think again, that's, I'm probably not making the point correctly, but we've become kind of, we've lost our moorings and we've lost our anchor. You know, America is still a Christian nation. I mean, you know, we still have a lot more people going to church than Europe does, obviously, but I think we're kind of adrift. And yeah, all these other things, depression and loneliness, all these things kind of feed off of that. And we don't have the community. We don't have the church's kind of hold on community or all the other community organizations and things that used to hold the community together. I think we've lost a lot of that. Mental illness, the rise of homelessness, it all kind of feeds itself. And I think America's lost something. And that would be another book, someone else, maybe you could write, Mark, but how do we get that back? It's easy to say everyone needs to start going to church on Sunday, but it's more than that. We are going through changes in society, economically and culturally, that I think we just have not been able to get a grasp of, and hopefully we can, but I don't have an answer to that. So what ails us, we can talk about bringing back the culture and doing all these things, and that will help, but I think there's more happening here that we're going to need other answers for. Maybe it's another great awakening. I mean, that may be happening, but, you know, I it's hard to pinpoint when that would happen or how it can happen, but that may be what we need, Mark, is another great awakening.
Yeah, and of course, it's not just America that's facing cultural decline or in crisis. The whole Western world, in fact, some places much worse than America. At the end of the book, you bring up Constantinople. It's an ancient city, of course, that was once the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire until it finally fell to Muslims in 1453. That magnificent church there, the Hagia Sophia, was converted to a mosque, and then a museum, and then in recent years back to a mosque again. Constantinople sometimes feels like a symbol of the West falling to Islam, which you write two or three essays about in this book about Islam. You traveled to Constantinople recently. What was your experience there? When you were there, did you feel the weight of that kind of tragic sense of an historic inevitability about the end of the West?
Well, absolutely. Constantinople is kind of the, you know, it's the symbol of the fall of the West and the fall of Christendom. Really, the first kind of, you know, domino to fall in a way, because now Europe is just being overrun with, you know, the Islamic immigration, which is changing the culture. And I don't know, France and England, are they too far gone? A lot of churches are going to be converted to mosque in the future, I'm afraid. But Constantinople and Hagia Sophia are kind of the one great symbol. And that, you know, it's heartbreaking to go there and you know, see all the Islamic symbols, that the fact that it's been turned into a mosque again. I mean, you can see where a lot of the mosaics have been kind of either torn or, you know, erased. And it, there's a few still parts of that beautiful cathedral that you know, speak of its greatness as a Eastern Orthodox basilica and church, but that, you know, it's faded, you know, it's incredibly faded. So as beautiful it is, and as I think as grateful as I was to be able to see it, it was heart-wrenching, heartbreaking. And, you know, where is the greatness of, you know, where's the kind of greatness, you know, going to come? That's where nostalgia kicks in big time for me, Mark, is can we make Hagia Sophia a great Christian cathedral again? Can the empire rise again? And can that be like one of the seats of Eastern Orthodoxy? Probably not. Maybe in a different lifetime. I don't know. I get incredibly depressed and kind of wistful when I think about, you know, but even Yeats wrote, you know, Sailing to Byzantium. There's a greatness in Constantinople, the great white city that, you know, again, that becomes nostalgia, and that can become, I guess, a little, not dangerous, but, you know, we need to be in reality, but that's happening all over Western Europe. There are warning signs here. Our great friend and colleague Robert Spencer writes about that in America. Mosques are popping in your new home state of Texas. Mosques are popping up quite a bit, and states like Tennessee. We see what's happening in Dearborn, Michigan. We're not as far down that path as France, certainly, or England, but we're not that far behind. And the fact that it could happen here, there, it could certainly happen here. So, I still think World War I was the event that really turned Christendom. I think, you know, that was a huge turning point. And I think in this decline of Western civilization and Western civilization as being Christian and that, and, you know, philosophically, we still are to a great degree, and there are parts of Europe, but it's, you know, we're under attack, and now we're under attack by the same forces that overthrew the Byzantine Empire and destroyed the Constantinople that was, you know, so great. So, yeah, I get emotional thinking about this because, you know, how do we turn this around? How do we recover it? And it's not just Constantinople, all of, you know, what is now Turkey and Syria and the whole, that was really the heart of, before Rome and the Catholic Church, that was the heart of Christendom. You know, the Eastern Church for hundreds of years, that was really the center of Christianity. And that's all gone, right? Christians have almost been completely eliminated from that part of the world. So, you know, how do we turn that around and reverse that? Another great question, which, you know, I don't have an answer for, but hopefully we can come up with one.
Well, I think it's time we launched a new crusade to reclaim Constantinople. So I'm getting a sign-up sheet started to get that launched.
Well, the Russians tried that. And actually, it was England and France that, you know, the Crimean War and a lot of other, they tried to stop the czars of Russia. They wanted to reclaim Constantinople as the seat of the Eastern Church. And they were stopped, you know, obviously the Ottoman Turks, but the Ottoman Turks were declining after the fall of Vienna. After they couldn't take Vienna, they got pushed back. Russia saw that as an opening. They started making the advances south, and they wanted to take back Constantinople for the Orthodox Church. And it was France and England that were worried about the rise of Russia that came in and helped stop the Russians. So sometimes we are our own worst enemy. And just another, and I don't talk about this in the book, but Constantinople, one of the worst things that happened to Constantinople before the Turks was one of the Crusades. And I'm a huge fan of the Crusades, and I'll sign that petition. but the Crusaders went in and just destroyed it. I mean, they took all the great art of Constantinople. They just wrecked havoc. One of the worst moments, and besides the fall to the Turks, the Ottomans, was what one of the Crusades did to Constantinople. So it'd be nice if the Christians in this world and the churches could unite. But that's probably fanciful. I don't know if we'll ever really, and maybe that's one of the things that we just going to have to struggle with as a divided Christian world.
Mike, how can people get hold of your books? And are you much of a social media guy? Can people keep up with you online somehow?
Not really. I'm sorry to say. I mean, obviously you can get the book at Amazon, or you can go to frontpagemag.com. to the bookstore and order it there. I have a Twitter or X account, but it's in its infancy, and I can't even, to be honest, Mark, I'll have to look it up, but I can't remember the, I'm sadly lacking in the social media world.
No, I think social media is overrated. I think it's a net negative, actually, for the world. But listeners, if you want to read somebody who cares deeply about restoring American exceptionalism and centering God and country in our lives without all the anger and combativeness and snarkiness that marks most of our political discourse these days, of which I am actually guilty, you can't do better than to look up Mike's work, like this new book, A Time to Stand. Michael Finch, thanks for joining us at The Right Take, and keep up the great work.
Mark, thank you. I'm very grateful. I really appreciate it. Great to have this conversation, and I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
My pleasure, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.